I'd like to call to order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. The time is 7 after 8 a.m. on February 2nd. Present are Representatives Gardner, Osterman, Representative Dick, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Chair Munoz. I would ask that you all turn your cell phones off because they do interrupt the system, the telephone system here. We have three bills on the calendar, HB 170, which is a municipal tax exemption for certain volunteers, HB 290, which would establish the Alaska Endow Fund, and HB 184, refund of fish business tax to municipalities. And we're going to start with HB 170. Representative Feige is the sponsor of this bill. It has been in committee previously. Last year we heard the bill on two occasions, on March 24th and again on April 12th. We took public testimony, and as you remember, there were some concerns with the way the bill was written. The bill sponsor has addressed those concerns and is here to take questions. The intention is to move the bill today, but I'd like to invite Representative Feige forward to discuss those changes. And as a, go ahead and speak to, I wonder if we should adopt the CS first. We have a CS. Yes. Okay, let's go ahead and get the CS on the table, and then you can speak to those changes. So if I could have a motion, please. And that's in your packet, version I.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I would move HB 170, the CS version 27L. S0562/I.
Thank you. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the CS is before us. Thank you, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Eric Feige, representing District 12. House Bill 170, now you have adopted the CS, was introduced last year. As the chairman said, there were several questions members of the committee brought up. We went back over the interim. We believe we have addressed those concerns on the part of the committee. And at this point, I'll pass it off to my aide, Mike Paschal, who will answer any questions you may have on the changes that we made.
Go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Michael Paschal, staff representative Feige. And last year during the latter of the two times the bill appeared before the committee, there were several questions raised. And so what I want to do is just briefly recap the bill and then address those questions. This bill gives an opportunity for the state to reimburse two municipalities the property tax that is paid by responders, first responders, fire, EMS personnel, if the municipality so chooses to enact an ordinance to allow that to take place. We originally introduced the bill as an opt-out, but it was changed to an opt-in, so there's no obligation on the part of the municipality to do this unless they so choose. Okay. And as many of you know, the firefighters have been here this week. I'm a volunteer firefighter, and I was talking to my brothers the other night, and one of the mentions was, well, you know, you always have the dirty dozen, and you do. Everybody's got the dirty dozen, the 8, 10, 12 guys that are always there. That's not what this is about. It's about the another 10, 15 that you need in your department in order to have a large number. So it provides an incentive if the municipality chooses to put that incentive in place. The bill, as I say, that's the meat of the bill. Okay. There were some questions last year concerning what one was whether or not there was an annual application. That's up to the municipality to determine how they're going to require that, but it would only make sense to me, since this is an annual property tax, that you would require someone to apply every year in order to be exempted from the tax. There was a question about qualifying an active volunteer. And although we defined a volunteer in the statute, because we had to limit this, we couldn't just say any volunteer. We had to say what type of volunteer. So we took an existing definition in statute that defined a volunteer. The purpose of that statute was for obtaining a hepatitis shot for emergency workers. So we just used that as because the base was already there to say these are the volunteers it applies to. But specifically, if you want a smaller group or an active volunteer was one of the terms we used, that's for the municipality to define. How many, you know, does somebody have to be participate 100 hours a year or 1,000 hours a year in order to qualify? That's up to the municipality to define. There was also a question about the widow or widowers, because that's part of the provision is allowing them. And the same, if they get remarried, do they qualify? Again, the municipality can define that. Do they have to apply every year? Do they only receive the exemption for 5 years after the death of their spouse? Again, the municipality can define all of those rules. So that's what we wanted to bring forth there. And also the one last question that I got out of the testimony last year was paid on-call volunteers. And again, that the municipality in some cases, I know in Nome, for example, they already give their volunteers a credit on their electrical bill. Okay. Does that make them paid on call? Well, that's up to them to determine. But if they don't, but they're already providing the incentive. But there's some municipalities that don't have that opportunity. So that's what this gives them the opportunity to do. And from there, I'll take any questions.
Okay. Are there questions? Please let the record show, too, that we've been joined by Representative Sadler. Okay, Representative Dick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3, lines 4 through 10, would you help me understand that, please?
That provision there, Part D, simply provides an opportunity for the state to reimburse a municipality for the exemptions, just as they do for the senior exemption. The statute is almost identical from that standpoint. The state at one point reimbursed for that, but they no longer do. The same thing here. If the state recognized this as a need, then you as a legislative body could fund a reimbursement for the lost revenue the municipalities would have.
Hello?
Go ahead.
But on line 4, I see shall.
That's the normal language in the bills for these programs. As I looked at several of them, they all say shall. But since the legislature is required to provide appropriations through a separate bill, if there's no appropriation, then there's no appropriation.
Okay. On that point, how long has it been since the state has actively reimbursed the municipalities for the senior exemption?
I did have that number, and I don't remember offhand, but I believe it's been about 10 years, 10 or 12 years.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I had the same question with the language as Representative Dick did, I think, on line 7 of that. It's the clause, only to the extent the law exceeds an exemption that was granted by the municipality. And you might have just explained that, Mike, but is that from the senior exemption?
Yes, that's from the senior exemption. In other words, the municipality can't be reimbursed twice.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Question, Representative Dick.
This is another question. I don't know what to point to here. So I guess my question is, what's to keep a giant landslide if everybody joined the volunteer fire department in order to get it out of paying taxes?
I would be a very happy person if that would happen. I don't think people are going to put the time in. Again, if you look at myself, I probably spend, I don't know, 1,800 hours a year as a volunteer. So if the municipality says you have to put in 500 hours or 1,000 hours, you know, that would be a fantastic event if that were to be the case. So.
Okay. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. understanding that the language about may and shall is following a template in existing statute, I'd like to know how the sponsor would feel. I mean, given that our intention is, or I believe your intention is, that it be may and not mandating it, about an amendment to make that very clear.
I don't believe you'd object to the use of may there instead of shall.
No.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about, I'm going to ask some general questions about the applicability or the scope of this program. I know from my experience the Chugach Volunteer Fire Department does a fine job. It's inside the municipality of Anchorage. How many volunteer fire departments are there in the state that could be potentially affected by this?
I counted 78 departments where that are in a municipality that has a property tax. There are approximately 250 fire departments in the state. There are approximately 7,000 firefighters, 4,000 of which are volunteers, and approximately 1,500 of them live in a property taxed assessed municipality. We did a study of the Girdwood Fire Department because they had the information available, and it'd take me just a moment to find those numbers, but as I remember it, they had 30-some volunteers. They had 14 of them that actually owned property within the community.
I've been trying to thank you. Trying to think how this would apply in the circumstance I'm familiar with. How would it happen if this bill were to pass? What would be the flow chart of activities? For example, in Anchorage, I don't know if you're familiar with that situation, but would all the voters of Anchorage have to vote to grant this exemption to a situation where in Anchorage there is a city fire department, there is a volunteer fire department within the municipality's borders? I live in a fire service area, and that's how the Chugach Volunteer Fire Department gets their monies, is through the fire service. Would all the voters in the muni have to vote to provide that exemption to the Chugach Volunteer Fire Department?
No, this law provides the provision that the governing body of the municipality can grant the exemption.
Okay, mm-hmm. So the assembly.
Yeah, the assembly in this case, yes.
Where is that section there, Frank?
That is on page 1, line 12.
Okay. Made by ordinance. Okay, by the assembly. Okay, good deal. And, of course, I think I've heard the sponsor say before that there is no guarantee that the state would fund this. That's by discretion and subject to available to appropriations. And the pro rata provision exists still in the bill, right? So if there was a limited appropriation, then the – okay.
Yes.
What is the potential cost to the state? And I don't know how you calculate that. If every department takes advantage of this, if half of them do, or you know, what's the exposure to the state here?
That was one of the problems we ran into in trying to answer that question. When you start looking, you identify the departments. You can identify their rosters. From there, you can go to the tax rolls. But it became a question of how much. Time should Ledge Research spend on that. Let me tell you what we determined with Girdwood, which I think is a fairly typical example. Actually, the Girdwood Department, has 51 members that are listed in the state registry as members of that department. Okay. They were able to match 12 properties that had the same name as members of that department. So whether they were living with they brought up the point, well, they could be living with somebody, a relative with the same name or something, but they of the 51, they were only able to match 12. Okay. And of those 12 properties, the assessed value was $3.9 million, and the average property value was $329,500. Property values ranged from $194,000 to $765,000. Mm-hmm. And one other part here, and this is where I mentioned the Dirty Dozen earlier. Most of us that are very active in our departments are in departments for years. I've been in Delta Junction for 7.5 years, and I've been in the department for 7. I did this previously. So we're there long term. But we have people come and go, and a lot of those people aren't going to own property. But also it is an incentive for people to put down roots in the community that are serving the community. We developed someone up as I've got two captains that are leaving in the next month or two. They've been in the department 3 or 4 years, might be some incentive to keep them in the community.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sisnun. Please let the record note that we've been joined by the representative. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And sir, I am assuming that you're from the fire department.
I am, yes.
But a huge number of fire departments actually have the emergency health medical.
In most communities in Alaska, the EMS service is provided by the fire departments, and the numbers I used include those personnel as well.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The thing that I spent a month really looking into emergency services and have gone to a number of communities and try to meet with the fire department and the emergency services at the same time. And the thing that's just been fascinating to me is huge percentage in Alaska, the emergency services are volunteer, if I'm not mistaken. And in little communities, it's oftentimes those are the people that are helping at the clinic when things get bad and that they're not making it. They wouldn't make it if it weren't for that part of the community that's really there volunteering all the time and having fundraisers and doing all of these things to keep things, spent a day in Hope and took pictures of the people in Hope that were constantly working on trying to dig out equipment in the winter so that it'd be accessible and actually putting their lives on hold kind of indefinitely. So I think this is really good work. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the best of possible worlds, the state has lots of revenue. We do take the steps necessary to provide that, and this exemption is offered. It's taken advantage of, and recruitment and retention of volunteer fire departments, you know, works well. Everything's a great system. To look at the other side, in case things don't go well, there isn't the money available. The state does not provide, after a couple of years, this money. What happens to a community that goes through the process, votes in the exemption, the state funds it for a while, then stops funding it? What happens then if you've got, you know, 1% of the community is firefighters and has the exemption? Have you wargamed that scenario? What it would mean?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. Obviously, the thought's gone through my mind. I would prefer that not to happen, but it is a reality. I don't think many of the volunteers would revolt, as a, I guess, a choice of words. I think they would accept the fact that the state doesn't have the money anymore to provide this benefit and incentive to them. The municipality would be in a position to repeal the ordinance and end the program, just as the state would, if the state were to end the funding to the program.
Do you think it's kind of hard to prognosticate. Do you think that boroughs, the assemblies, city councils would actually vote to kill the program? They would essentially have the state on the hook. Why would they want to abandon that against the fear that happy days would never return again? Because they haven't done that for the – I'm sorry, no, withdraw.
Yeah. Representative Sadler, through the chair, I don't know that I could really answer that question for them. I think it's a possibility. There's something here that I guess would be interesting. The Homer Fire Department, back in March last year, this happens to be an EMS newsletter, not a fire newsletter, but one of their members sat down and looked at the amount of time that members spend on call and responding and all of that, and looked at 2010 that the fire department budget was $971,000, and that the total cost of his estimate at normal wages for the same services that were provided was $3.6 million. That's what it would have cost had the city of Homer have to provide these services through paid staff versus volunteers. So that's the dilemma that I think the municipal body is faced with, is if we're losing so many members that we can't provide the service, do we start paying people? And that's an estimate of what it would cost in the city of Homer.
Fair enough. And I think to say for the record, I do admire the motivation of this effort. I personally support our local volunteer fire department with money, and they help take care of me and my family, and I appreciate that very much. I'm sorry that it's difficult to keep good people working a long time. My concern is that we're setting up a situation where we might offer this incentive, boroughs, municipalities take advantage of it, enjoy the exemption for a while, and then face a situation when the other people who are not firefighters in the community have to pick up the burden. It might be a little resentful. You know, property tax is a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard some testimony that local businesses are concerned that their property taxes might go up. So that's kind of the worst-case scenario I'm trying to guard against.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe that is the worst-case scenario, but if you take that same equation and turn it around a little bit, remember that these individuals are taking their own time to help these same people that aren't providing for the funding for the service that's in place. So, you know, they're getting up at, as the people in my department did Sunday night at 10:30, went out when it wasn't too cold. I think it was 28 below to a barn fire, and were out until 3:30 in the morning, and then back again later in the morning. And most of those people had to be at work at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, these are the people that we're trying to help with this bill.
Yeah. And there, I know the public service occasionally goes unappreciated, but it should not go unrewarded.
And if, through the chair, Representative Sadler, if I could add a point. Again, this is Representative Feige for the record. municipality gets what it pays for when it comes to emergency services. And the more capability and the more, the greater the ability to fight fires or provide EMS, one, it's better service to the citizens, which they may or may not demand, but at the same time, it directly impacts home insurance rates on that community, which if you look at the overall savings in a community can be very significant. Just the fact that we now have a fire department in my community, for the people that choose to participate, that is the homeowners that choose to participate, not the volunteers, there is about a 15% to 20% savings on their home insurance rates, which obviously the amount of money you save depends on the value of your property. Nonetheless, if a municipality has the demand for the, you know, a certain quality of fire department, they can either choose to pay for it themselves directly out of pocket, you know, as in a professional, you know, firefighters there all the time, or they can choose to basically get their labor source from volunteers. And it is far cheaper for a municipality to get their labor from volunteers than it is to go out and pay for an equivalent service. And I think that's it's why we've gone to mostly volunteer types of labor pools, you know, in these departments and it's sort of a social requirement to have some way to prevent, you know, fight fires. So that, again, I think that's a major consideration, and it's a consideration the municipalities have to make based on their own criteria and their own set of conditions. But this bill basically allows for that. It gives the municipalities a large degree of flexibility. We're not making it possible for them to do it, but we're not mandating that they have to do it.
Representative Osterman and then Representative Sisna.
The job of the committee is to sit here and have these discussions and open the bill up and discuss every possibility of it. There's no fiscal note attached to it right now, is there?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, there was a fiscal note attached to the original bill. It's a zero fiscal note because there's no administration required by the state, and there's no appropriation with this bill.
Although it says it shall pay this.
But until the legislature appropriates the money, there's no money to be spent.
Chair, part of the discussion of the committee, both here and in finance, is to make those determinations, though. And so while we have a zero fiscal note, I think that it would behoove us, as conversation is taking place here, that there's going to be cost to it if the state pays it to the state, that this should be maybe an undetermined fiscal note that goes out of this committee to finance so that they can concentrate more on what it's what the real cost is going to be.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I need verification that I think it was about 6 years ago that I spent the time looking into EMS, their program. And I was at the time in an interim and in Anchorage and finding out what was happening between Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, where you have a huge amount of traffic. And in that case, what you're really looking at is the people who are the lifeline, that magical hour that is the difference between life and death, and you've got to have somebody to medical services immediately within that hour if you're going to save their lives or save really horrible things. The fascinating part of that I found, and I don't know if it still exists, but was that the services that are going to be called into place if all of a sudden, and at the Hope turnoff, there is the phone beside the road to call the EMS service, and it may even be tied to the fire department. I think they're the same thing. But what that means is you've got a municipal area that's tiny, that doesn't have a huge number of people, and yet that's the lifeline that Anchorage has if there's an accident there, and there are a lot of accidents there, between life and death. And it's volunteers. And I think the same is true with Girdwood. So it's Girdwood, then many miles, then you've got Hope, and then it's many more miles down to Cooper Landing or one of those, all volunteer. So you talk about the fiscal note. The fiscal note is kind of a weird one because you're talking about homes in very small communities. So it isn't. It's going to be a different price tag than, and it may even be a minus price tag because you're really keeping sure that they're in place for those of us who live in very large municipal area that travel down there constantly. So it's a kind of a strange thing that the state is really dependent on volunteer people for health, and health costs so much, and yet this stuff is free practically.
Representative Sisna, through the chair, you know, in our department we have approximately 33 members, although we don't provide EMS services provided by another volunteer department, but our area that we provide service to is about the size of the state of Vermont.
Well, and I just want to add, this is not free. You know, that if we go ahead and pass this and if it becomes law, municipalities in my community, an average home, the taxes on the home would be about $2,000. So my feeling, and this is coming from a perspective of being on the local city assembly for 7 years, is that if we go forward with this, the state should really back it up financially, because we give so many unfunded mandates to the local municipalities, and this is another one of those unfunded mandates. Or even though it's an opt-in, there's a political pressure to do it. So I think, you know, I think we need to be really clear on that. Representative Osterman?
And the reason I think that we should have an undetermined fiscal note on this is because it's implied. I don't want it to go out of here with municipalities thinking that the state shall pay them to reimburse them if they opt in. And I want to make it very clear that, and as you indicated, it's been maybe 10 years since they paid on the seniors. It doesn't necessarily mean that all the municipalities are going to pay attention, although they might just see the state shall reimburse. I think it should go out of here with knowing that we have had that discussion and that it's up front, that the potential is that the state shall, or and senior citizens, they will not pay. So it's just a matter of making sure that we have that conversation and have it clear on the record as we move this bill through.
Representative Sisna.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I made the comments I did was because what we don't oftentimes look at is what is the cost not to. And if we have communities that lose those volunteer people, then we lose our lives. And I think fiscal notes oftentimes don't look at that part of it. They don't look at the benefit, the cost of the benefit that is there. They look at the money going out in that department that's looking at it. They're not looking at the benefit to that department by having that service.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either Mike or Representative Feige, there is a testimony from a gentleman named Thomas Andreessen. Looks like he's from the Haynesboro. And he makes reference to, quote, there is already an optional tax reduction for emergency responders that boroughs can adopt, and I believe it is a 15% reduction in the members' tax. Making this a mandate would be more appropriate than the current proposed House bill. What do you know what he's referring to?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I do not know specifically what he's referring to, and there's no one here from Ledge Legal, but if my mind serves me correctly, a $20,000 property value exemption can be enacted by an assembly or either by the voters in a municipality currently for any purpose. I think they can reclassify property or something to that effect, and I'm not familiar with the details, and I don't know if he's referring to that or referring to something that borough particularly is doing for its members. Again, offering incentive, but what we wanted to do was make it a statewide opportunity to offer it.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. I thought there might be some confusion because we had that in Anchorage where you, for whatever reason, I don't know if they applied to that specifically or if it's something special to that borough, but it'd be kind of nice to know more about that.
Okay, I also want to let the committee members know that online we have Scott Ruby, Director of Division of Community and Regional Affairs, available for questions, as well as Steve Van Sant, the State Assessor. Are there questions at this point for either of those individuals or the bill sponsor? Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the question I was kind of getting close to is, in fact, in communities that are, I mean, for instance, Anchorage pays, I think, most of the firefighters are on the paycheck. They aren't volunteers, and it's usually smaller communities, as I understand it, that do have the really hefty number of volunteers. And so many times those people are the ones that keep the rest of us that are in urban centers alive when we're traveling from one place to the other. And so we're kind of shifting responsibility in a way here. Can both of our department people speak to that and what the property values are in the smaller communities, for instance, like Hope and Girdwood, and if, in fact, keeping people in those communities that keep Anchorage safe, if people in that area, if their property value is what it would be, what the taxation would be in those separate communities.
Okay, Steve, are you online with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
And you heard the question. It's a broad question, probably difficult to get to a specific answer, but can you give us some idea of property values in these rural communities and the benefit of providing the exemption versus having to pay for the volunteer services?
Madam Chair,
I know it's a difficult one to begin to answer, but maybe give us a broad perspective of your feelings about the bill, maybe, or the value issue in the rural communities.
Yeah, I can give an idea about the value issues in the community. For example, I don't have Hope because it's not a city, so it's not broken out for us. But in the places like we'll just pick Craig and Cordova, we're looking at $105,000 to $124,000 respectively. If we look at some place like Nenana, we're looking at $74,000. Tanana, $37,000. Valdez, pretty high because of the oil down there. But and these are per capita values, not per structure values. Petersburg, $118,000. Pelican, $162,000. Nome is $90,000. And Nenana, $74,000. That gives an idea of municipalities that do tax and the average values per capita in those municipalities.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers the question or not, but that's about the best we can do with value
right.
for you.
That's helpful. Thank you. Are there additional questions?
Follow up on that. Yeah. Thank you very much. Now, the taxation rate on those so is going to vary from community to community. Is that not true? And if you can, the range of actually what the taxation would be on property tax would be a good thing to get an idea of.
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, we have in Craig 6 mills, Cordova 9.7 mills, Nome 10 mills, Nenana 12 mills, Pelican 7, Petersburg 11, Valdez 20, Whittier 5. So the range is from 5 to 20 mills, most of them being around 6, 7 to 10 or 11.
Madam Chair, and for those of us who live in our right brain, not our left, can you tell us the dollar amounts kind of there for the per mill, high and low? The amount of money they're going to be paying in taxes? Because they're not going to pay for the
If I can just jump in, 10 sure. mills would be roughly $10 per $1,000 in value. So okay. 1,000, yes. So if you have a $100,000 home, you extrapolate that.
Yeah, year, let's right? extrapolate it right now okay. so that I have a dollar amount.
Okay. Steve, can you want to take a stab at that?
Madam Chair, this is Scott Ruby with DCRA. I might be able to help with this. My wife and I have a home in Moose Pass. Its value is, I believe, assessed at about $140,000 by the borough, and we pay $634 in property tax, and so to the borough on that. So if we had a $150,000 exemption, that entire $634 would be exempted.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions? No other questions. Okay. Thank you, Steve and Scott, for joining us today. Okay. Representative.
Thank you.
Gardner. Sorry.
I just have a quick question that's puzzling me a little bit. One of the letters of support makes reference to tax exemption on the first $200,000 value, and the bill itself says $150,000. Was it originally envisioned as for $200,000 and changed, or is that just an error on the part of the person who wrote that letter of endorsement?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the original version of the bill was $200,000.
Okay.
All right. I have a question on page 2, line 24. You state the governing body of the municipality for good cause shown may waive the claimant's failure to make timely application for exemption and authorize the assessor to accept the application as if timely. Why would you want to reward those applications that were not turned in a timely manner?
Madam Chair, without a better explanation, I think this was the language that has previously been in statute for optional exemptions, and so the legal in drafting the bill used the same language provisions, and we didn't have an objection one way or the other that I'm aware of to that.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a rhetorical question, I'm not an attorney. Is there anything right now prohibiting municipalities from allowing this exemption, from voting themselves this exemption without a state authorizing statute right now?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, again, as I addressed that question earlier, I believe there's a $20,000 I believe that is all the exemption that a municipality can offer, but I could be completely incorrect there.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Some of the other property tax exemptions that municipalities offer are only available to those who are eligible for a permanent fund dividend. Would that apply for this, or is that your intention, or you don't really care?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, this bill does provide a provision that they have to be eligible for the permanent fund in order to receive the exemption.
Thank you.
Okay. On the point of timely application, what is the sense of the committee? Do we want to leave that language in or remove it?
No, I have
a... You're fine with it? Everybody's okay with that?
Madam Chair, I think your time serving on the assembly has made you see it from the perspective of an assembly, and I'm fine with whatever you want to do on that.
Okay. Personally, I'd like to remove that language. I think if an applicant wants to make the application, they should do it in a timely manner, regardless of what it says in other aspects of the statute.
I would observe, too, I think the language of the bill also says you have to be a resident or a volunteer fire department employee or volunteer for 2 years prior. So there's some leeway, some lead time. You would know this is going to happen. So.
Okay. Okay. Shall I make the motion, or would Representative Dick, would you like? Okay. Is it? I don't think it's proper for the chair to make the motion, so if I could get another motion. The section is page 2, line 24.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I'll move amendment number 1, which would be to strike the language on page 2, line 23. Oh, excuse me. Let me just make sure. Line 24. The last word, the governing body of the municipality, for good cause shown, may waive the claimant's failure to make timely application for exemption and authorize the assessor to accept the application as if timely filed. Okay. And just strike that language.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, it is ordered. Amendment number 1 of the CS.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move amendment number 2.
Okay.
Which would be a one-word change on line, on page 3, line 4, strike the word shall and insert the word may.
Discussion on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to give a false sense of security to municipalities to expect, as they ponder, whether or not they want to opt in for this. I don't want to give them a false expectation that they can count on state funding of it if they do. Because they may or may not.
Discussion?
Input, I guess.
Would you like to comment on the amendment?
No, I don't have a problem with the amendment.
Okay. My personal feeling is I think the state should pay for it if we're going to do it. But, you know, I can see your point. I can see your point that it should be clear that maybe the state, you know, through the appropriation process wouldn't.
May or may not.
You know, may not do it. So, okay.
Madam Chair, if I might, we know that for a host of other programs, PCE from time to time, municipal revenue sharing, whatever. You know, it comes and it goes.
Okay. The amendment is to strike shall and add may on line 4, page 3. Is there objection to the amendment? Okay. Hearing no objection, the amendment is ordered. Amendment number 2, are there further amendments? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me the indulgence of kind of thinking out loud on this. I was thinking about this last night again, and I thought that it might be nice to have some kind of mechanism whereby the people who neighbors who would enjoy the benefits of the improved volunteer fire department services would incur some obligation for this exemption, and not just have it be a straight state gift, subsidy, enablement. So I don't know if I'm trying to scope out some kind of amendment whereby, if this is granted, that the local community would accept maybe a one-third obligation or be obligated to provide a match for the state funding for this exemption. And I'm not an experienced legislator, I'm not an attorney, I don't know what that mechanism might be. But before I even consider making that motion, I guess I'd ask the sponsor or the witnesses thoughts about that. Would it be appropriate to require some, God help me, skin in the game from the local communities?
And Representative Feige, by granting the exemption, they're essentially denying, or they're not taking in revenue. So the only way for the municipality to make that up is to raise the mill rate. As far as the state goes, the state may choose to refund a 100% of the exemption, or the state may choose to refund only half. And that's certainly a change you could make to the amendment. One assumes that if the municipality granted the exemption and found themselves to be short of funds to operate their government, they would then have to raise the mill rate if the state did not reimburse at 100%. So that's, again, still within the purview of the municipality to adjust their income, their revenue up or down. The separate issue is the state's decision to either refund 100%, 50%, 27.3%, whatever.
Yeah. That's fair. What I guess I'm trying to guard against is the situation we've seen with the property tax exemption for senior citizens, whereby the state offers it during a time of plenty and then pulls it back, and in that case leaves the obligation of the local communities. But in this case, would leave the expectation.
Well, yeah, I understand the point there, but still, it's the local municipality, it's their job to raise or lower their mill rates, their assessed values, whatever they want to do to raise revenue. There are so many really and truly unknowns with how much of a total dollar amount of exemptions that will be generated based on this bill. We may simply want to leave it at 100% and see what it turns out to be. Keep in mind, if a municipality is not having a recruitment issue in their local communities, then they don't need to enact an exemption. And that is their call. I'm not going to tell them that they have to or not. Certainly there could be some political pressure, but the political pressure is not going to come from that many people. It's going to come, who's going to want this exemption? Well, the guys that own property that are volunteering. And quite frankly, most, you have, as my aide explained, you have the dirty dozen of diehard volunteers that show up for every fire just for fun. But what you really need in departments, you need the labor. You need the guys to carry the hoses. I'm here to tell you, it's a young man's game. My biggest problem in my department, our population is a lot older on average. So a young guy in my department is maybe 40. So there's a certain reluctance to get out there and schlep a hose, something heavy all over the ground in the middle of the night. The degree to how much money this will, how much of a bill this will generate for the state, I'm not sure, but I think the other aspect of this bill, and I think Representative Sisna alluded to it, there's something of a moral obligation here to, let's put something out there. We're supporting. We want them to volunteer. It is a recruitment tool for the municipalities, and we'll see what the bill is. If we find that we can't stomach the bill, then that may be the time to make the adjustments.
Okay. The thing too is on that the municipality, if the state doesn't participate, has 100% skin in the game. So to say you're going to have 30% is kind of difficult.
And I'm not going to mess with the intent of the bill. I think you make a good case, so I will not offer any such amendment.
Further questions or amendments? Okay. So we have two amendments, and we have an indeterminate fiscal note. Do we have a motion on the bill?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll move HB 170, the CS version 27LS0562 / I with individual recognition in the indeterminate personnel.
And amendment.
As amended.
As amended. Is there objection? No objection. The bill will move out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we have a brief at ease while we take care of the report? The Community and Regional Affairs Committee back to order. Next on the agenda is HB 290, establishing an Endow Alaska Grant Fund, sponsored by Representative Osterman and presented today by Aaron Harrington of his staff. Thank you, Aaron. Go ahead. We do have a CS. I'm sorry. Before we get started, we need to adopt the CS. So let's see. Does everybody have that before you? It's version D?
No.
No.
Do you want to take a minute and get it pulled up?
Maybe I do.
Do you have a hard copy on your desk?
I do.
Berta, you have, I think, a hard copy on your...
Is that what this is?
Does anyone need a hard copy?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Can you email it?
We did.
Okay. All right.
Does everybody have version D before them? Can we have a motion to adopt the CS for 290 version D?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would I move that we adopt the work draft CS for HB 290 version 27-LS10904/D for Delta.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the CS is before us. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us. If you'd like to address the changes in the CS, and then we'll take questions.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Harrington. I'm staff to Representative Osterman. Before you have work draft, it's version D, CS, and in the committee hearing a week ago today, the committee raised a number of excellent questions that largely centered around the applicability of some aspects of the language to the circumstances we have here in Alaska. The language was originally drafted based on law in Iowa, where all communities are neatly packed into counties and things like that. That doesn't necessarily describe Alaska's situation with both unorganized areas and also communities and boroughs and also communities and independent municipalities that are not in boroughs. So, with the points that were raised by the committee and then also in work with folks from the Community Foundation community in Alaska who had been assisting with working on the draft, we made quite a few changes to House Bill 290 to address some of those concerns and essentially Alaskanize it, make it describe what's actually happening in Alaska. You have a change memo in your packets today, dated yesterday, and I just want to point out that incorrectly in that memo, it references version I, which is the only incorrect thing in the memo. Anywhere it says version I, just substitute version D. It is referring to version D, and if you would like a clean copy, I do have some of those. So essentially, I'll walk you through the changes pretty quickly, but I just want to point out that there are, in addition to changes that sort of Alaskanize the bill and make sure it describes accurately what's happening here in our state, there's also two policy-level changes that were highlighted in the memo. The first is that language has been added in the very first section of the bill that clarifies that the funds raised and matched through this program should are meant to grow the unrestricted endowed funds of a community foundation. Some community foundations hold funds within them that can be spent out annually or are intended only to benefit a particular, say, arts and cultural organization or sports group. These funds are meant to grow the general unrestricted endowed funds of community foundations, making them available into perpetuity to support a broad range of needs and communities as are determined by each generation of residents that are involved in making the decisions about where the earnings on those funds are spent. So that's the first policy level change. The second policy level change is that the CS removes the requirement that grantees of the program demonstrate substantial compliance with the national standards of the National Council on Foundations. That came out of continued discussion again with members of the community foundation community here in Alaska, and hearing some concerns that it might place an unnecessary hurdle on communities being able to access this program. You do have, I believe, a handout that just shows the timeline that's involved in getting Council on Foundations basically proving up to their standards, and it's fairly long. It's from takes anywhere from about 300 days to 450 days. So that's a long time, and there's cost associated, and there are only two community and foundations in Alaska that currently have meet this accreditation standard, and others have chosen not to do it, but I don't think that we question the quality of the work or the due diligence and commitment of those foundations. So is a policy level conversation, though. So I can just walk you quickly through the changes in the interest of time this morning, and then answer any questions you might have. So in the first section of the bill, 4433.150, language was added to lines 11 and 12 that clarified that the purpose is to increase unrestricted endowed funds, which is one of those two policy level changes I discussed. In the section 4433.160, which addresses eligibility, I believe it was Representative Gardner last week. There was some language in the old version that described the lead philanthropic entity as having membership from corporate and other entities. That does not accurately describe Alaska Community Foundation, which is envisioned as the lead philanthropic entity through this program, and so that language was deleted. We also then deleted language that talked about the Council on Foundations national standards compliance, that second of those policy level changes to the bill. Throughout the section, or throughout the bill, and particularly in section 4433.170, we replaced the language community affiliate organization with community foundation affiliate to more clearly describe what's happening here in Alaska and the language that we use to refer to the various entities in the state. We deleted from version B the language that was ambiguous that dealt with the ranking for applicants, and the language in there discussed community needs and the manner in which additional funds will address those needs. And given that these are perpetual funds, community needs at the time of application may be one thing, but we don't want to imply that the needs in 2013, somehow dictate the use of the funds in, 2085, when we expect them to still be there and supporting the communities. So it seemed ambiguous and it was removed for clarity. Language was inserted to clarify that that this program and the funding that comes through it should help to grow new community foundations as well as grow existing community foundations, just to make sure that it's clear to the lead philanthropic entity that the legislature would like to see gains in both areas. Language was replaced that on page 2, line 31, language was replaced from version B that used one language that didn't really describe what's actually happening in community foundations, so it's now called spending policy, whereas previously it was referred to as a plan for distributing grant funds. And then there was some inconsistency between definitions and section B4 on version B, which was on page 3, lines 3 through 5. And essentially it was just very cyclical, and I'll just say that I think perhaps Iowa's drafters aren't as strong as Alaska's drafters, so we just got rid of that language. In the following section, we just, again, tried to use this community foundation affiliate language to describe what's happening in Alaska. And then it was raised that, we had talked about no more than 5 grants received within a single borough in a year, but, of course, not all Alaska communities are in boroughs. And since we have other goals here that are outlined for, you know, how grants should be, grant funding should be considered, it just seemed prudent to remove that language, make it simpler and more clear. And then just a reordering in the final section of the bill and the definitions. There is a hierarchy, if you will, between community foundations and then the affiliates that rest underneath them. And so it seemed just more clear to reorder those to reflect that hierarchy. If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Sadler had requested last week that we provide a bit of a hierarchy to understand how that worked, and that is attached to the changes memo. It's the final page of that changes memo, and just quickly I'll say that there are community foundations. Community foundations can hold within them affiliate funds, which are known as community foundation affiliates for the purposes of this bill. They can have independent boards working at the local level. So, for instance, I'll use the example of the non-existent Kodiak Community Foundation that we may one day have. They would have a local level policy board, but they would be an affiliate to a higher level community foundation that would actually hold the funds and have the fiduciary responsibility for it. Representative Sadler also asked about partner. I believe when Candace Winkler from the Alaska Community Foundations testified, she talked about partner foundations. These are so if Alaska Community Foundations is a separate entity and Juneau Community Foundation is a separate entity. Juneau Community Foundation is a partner to ACF because they have deposited a portion of their endowed funds at ACF, although they hold the rest independently and locally in the community. So that's what makes them a partner. It essentially is a requirement of a previous funding program, and so a portion of their endowed funds are held in the overall ACF corpus, but they're completely independent as an organization. Confusing, yes? Yeah. I can try to clarify that more if you have questions. And then finally, the committee requested that a little bit of information be provided about the Iowa and Kentucky programs. That's the second to the last page of the memo. It just talks about some of the results that they saw, and I would just highlight, I believe we talked about this last week, but from June 2010 through 2011 in Iowa, endowed funds grew by $100 million, and they've grown from 20 community foundations at program inception to 130 today. Iowa's investment in the grant portion of their program was over 4 years, $200,000. They also have a tax credit portion that continues today, but essentially seeded by $200,000, they were able to really kick up a conversation in the state that has had great results. And Madam Chair, those are the changes, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erin, could you show me where in the change memo that hierarchy of foundations and affiliates and?
Sure, it's the final page. Representative Adler through the chair. It's
that's the bill.
Final page of
the memo. The memo.
Yeah, the memo.
Representative Sadler, I'll provide you just another copy. It looks like maybe you're missing a page.
What it looks like.
It's a bulleted hierarchy.
I don't have that either.
You don't? Okay, here it comes.
Hey, Terry, could you make sure that everybody has that? That. Thank you. No, I don't have it either.
Yep, now I see it. You dropped off
some copies. Okay, thanks. Representative Sadler, I did attempt to make a very nice, pretty colored chart, and I have no creative ability whatsoever, but I can do bullet points very well, so.
Good deal. Now we have it. Thank you.
Okay. I would like to allow Diane Kaplan, who's online, to provide testimony. Diane was invited at the request of the committee last time we discussed that there was a general consensus that we wanted to hear the perspective from the Rasmussen Foundation. Diane, are you online? Diane?
Yes, I am online, Madam Chair.
Diane, could you make a statement on this bill and give us some of your perspective as a longtime administrator of the Rasmussen Foundation?
Sure, I'd be very pleased to, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Diane Kaplan, President and CEO of Rasmussen Foundation, based in Anchorage, Alaska, statewide family foundation started by the Rasmussen family. In the 1800s, Solomon Guggenheim and J.P. Morgan made a lot of money in Alaska. And if you go to New York today, you can see the legacy of the fortunes that were made in Alaska at the Guggenheim Museum and the J.P. Morgan Library. None of the dollars that they earned in Alaska ended up benefiting Alaskans in the future. In more recent years, I met a woman in Seattle whose father had a very thriving business here in Anchorage. She actually attended West High School with Ed Rasmussen. She's lived all of her adult life in Seattle. There's a foundation with the family's name. All of the money that was earned to fund that foundation was earned in Alaska, and all of the grants made by that foundation are made to organizations in Seattle, where she now lives. I'm hoping through initiatives like this that we can stop the trend of people earning lots of money in Alaska, doing well in Alaska, but having the long-term benefits of those fortunes benefit other places in the U.S. In 2005, in recognition of this, Rasmussen Foundation created an initiative called the Community Asset Building Initiative. We did this in concert with colleagues around the country who had done similar efforts in places like Indiana with the Lilly Foundation, in Minnesota, in Michigan with the Mott Foundation, to create community funds to give people who are philanthropic a vehicle through which they can provide long-time support for the organizations in the communities where they lived and thrived and earned money over time. Through that initiative, we now have new funds in places like Seward, in Haines, in Petersburg, at Talkeetna. Each of these communities stepped forward and desired to create a permanent endowment to benefit their communities in the long term and the organizations people value. We provided a lot of technical assistance through the Alaska Community Foundation, which is the lead partner, and also worked with existing affiliates like the Juno Foundation and the Homer Foundation, which had been previously established. And through that, today, we have a whole new opportunity for philanthropic Alaskans. Most recently, a gentleman in Seward, Tony Rollo, who was a laborer who nobody in town knew had any assets whatsoever, passed away, and he left almost $2 million to the Seward Community Fund at the Alaska Community Foundation. If that fund had not been created in 2005 through this effort, those dollars would not be there today to benefit Seward for the long term. Our board, in recognition of this just in December, approved an additional $2 million from the Rasmussen Foundation to help establish three or four new affiliate funds at the Alaska Community Foundation in the future. We hope Kodiak might be one of those communities that comes forward. There are many other communities, Ketchikan, Fairbanks has a new foundation, but it really hasn't gotten up and going. There are many places in Alaska that need a community foundation. The Matsu Valley is another place. So we very much were delighted to hear from Representative Osterman that he was viewing this as an opportunity for Alaska. We think it's very timely because we have allocated quite a bit of funding to provide the technical assistance that would help communities apply for these funds and be successful in moving it forward. Frankly, we would hope that there could be a lot more money than is even proposed, because we found that $25,000 in the challenge grants we did was about the right size for a community the size of Petersburg or Haines or Talkeetna, but probably inadequate for a community like Fairbanks or Kodiak, perhaps in the future, where there are a lot more people and a lot more assets in play. We would comment, we absolutely support the policy change in the new CS about supporting unrestricted endowments. We think that's where the sweet spot is on this project. We do like the Council on Foundations national standards. Our Alaska Community Foundation already meets them, so I don't think that's a reason not to move this bill forward. I would say the statewide language in terms of the lead organization did drop out of this new CS, and I think it should be in there, because you want to have an organization administering these funds that has a statewide board and a statewide perspective. Happy to answer any questions. We think this is an excellent opportunity. In fact, Our congressional delegation is supporting a very similar bill on the national level that's soon to be introduced, called the Rural Philanthropy Growth Act, through the USDA to do a very similar program on a national level. And you might know that the former governor of Iowa, who established this program in Iowa, is now the secretary of USDA, so knows very well the value of establishing permanent assets in communities like we have in Alaska. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Diane. We really appreciate your testimony today. Are there questions for Ms. Kaplan? I'm sorry, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane, a question I asked last time we had the hearing, and I'll ask you, you've got experience in large, more institutional, very successful philanthropies. My question is, in your experience or perspective, if this kind of thing were created, the Endow Alaska Fund were created in Alaska, what would be the effect on charitable giving to the less organized, more informal philanthropies in the state? Do you think money would tend to flow towards the more structured community affiliates and away from the, you know, pie suppers for the volunteer fire department kind of thing? Or I know it would increase the total take, but what would be the effect in Alaska, do you think, of creating this?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think Eagle River is a good community to use as an example. That's a very new community fund. We supported a major effort they did to put a clock in the downtown area. A lot of local people in Eagle River, Chugiak area supported that. And that's exactly the kind of very local project that gets a lot of people to make a donation for the very first time when you have that. And then there are local institutions that will need support over time. So you might have people in town, for example, who have supported the library in Eagle River. They may be getting up in years. They may have taken care of their kids, or they don't have any. They're going to have some money when they pass away, and they'd like a way to permanently benefit that Eagle River Library. Well, without having that Eagle River Community Fund, there would be no way to do that. And I think people tend to, some of us have a statewide or national or international perspective, but most people like their giving to benefit locally. So the real benefit here is establishing those local funds, so there can be a Kodiak fund, a Palmer fund, a Dillingham fund, so people who really are attached to those locales can support them. And Seward right now has about $2.3 million. That generates over $100,000 every year in perpetuity for Seward organizations. So I think it's a great model, and it's already proven to be successful in just a few short years.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Okay, thank you, Diane. I do see the benefit of having the local foundations create some more high profile, creates a mechanism. My experience has been, just reading literature, that philanthropy is pretty well tracked across the country. I've seen different socioeconomic demographics graded by their philanthropy. And in times of national prosperity, it goes up. In times of national prosperity, depression, it goes down. But again, is there any kind of a measurement of how the less organized institutional philanthropies benefit? Does that benefit at the expense of the smaller Boy Scout raffles, you know, cheerleading squads, that kind of thing? And what I'm trying to get to is, does this creation of the more structured philanthropies and a state match or a state grant have any impact on the other giving patterns?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think a good way to think about this is think about the checks that go to the Boy Scout raffle or those kinds of things comes out of the checking account. And the things we're talking about here would come out of the savings account. What we're really talking about is establishing the savings account for the long-term needs and giving philanthropic individuals a way to endow the things that they care about. And those generally come, most of them, from estate gifts when people pass away, frankly. Some people like to do it while they're alive, but the vast majority of assets you see, just as an example, the Rasmussen Foundation. The Rasmussen Foundation was a $6 million foundation when I first got here. It was when Elmer Rasmussen passed away that his majority of his estate passed the foundation. Now we're a $500 million foundation. So that's really, even though often these funds are established with small amounts, where the big dollars generally come are from estates, from people who pass away. And very often, you know, teachers, janitors, people who are laborers who have very modest incomes often save up a fair amount of money through their retirements over time. So it's easy to underestimate the assets in communities, but we know that there are, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 millionaires in Alaska right now. And they're not easy to find, but we know through the research that's been done, there are significant assets, and we want to make sure they stay in Alaska and don't go south because there's no vehicle to support the local organizations in place in that community.
So again, the foundations would raise their money more from wills or life insurance beneficiaries or behests and so forth, which answers the question why my Ohio State Alumni Association gives writing me more and more as I get past 50.
Representative Sather, I know exactly what you mean.
Erin Harrington had a comment.
And Madam Chairman and Representative Sadler, just to point out that on the second to last page of your memo, the one that has information on Endow Iowa and Endow Kentucky, under the spreadsheet table, it says program successes and then a note. So in a transfer of wealth study, looking at wealth that will be transferring as people pass away in Iowa, they predicted that between 2020 and 2049, nearly $500 billion is going to transfer hands in Iowa as baby boomers pass away. We can expect the scope to be smaller in Alaska, and yet still we can understand a little bit the approach that we're having here with thinking about major life changes, such as, for instance, passing away, being opportunities for this kind of giving.
Diane, you mentioned the importance of having a statewide lead organization. In the current CS, that language is retained on line one, but it's an option, really, of the department to identify the lead philanthropic entity using the word may instead of shall. Can you comment on that, please?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. I really believe it should say statewide in it, and it did. I think that there's no comment in the statement about the new CS. About removing that, so I'm just assuming it was inadvertent. But I think it is important to get buy-in to have a statewide entity administering those funds.
Okay. Great. Thank you for that. Are there additional questions? All right. Thank you, Diane, for joining us today. You're welcome to continue participating and hear it, listen in on the further testimony. But again, thank you for helping us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And next, we have Ken Kastner from Homer, the Homer Foundation. Ken, are you still with us?
I am.
Go ahead and please state your affiliation again and name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Kastner. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Homer Foundation, and they've authorized me to work on this bill. Three very brief comments. Unrestricted has is a term of art when used with these funds, and I know that you wanted to move into unrestricted purposes or benefits, but an unrestricted fund actually means to a community foundation a fund where both the corpus and the interest, so to speak, however you define what that distributable amount is through a spending policy, it is at the discretion of the board. So I'm a little concerned about that, although I agree with the intent. Number two, probably the growth that we would see through this bill would not be through new community foundations or even community foundation affiliates. I think that probably the growth in this bill, which is not prevented but is also not specifically allowed, would be through what I would call a community fund. And a community foundation is a basket of funds. And, for example, at the Homer Foundation, we have the City of Homer Fund and we have the Kachemak City Fund. And both of those funds are permanent endowments, which I think should qualify. And the purpose of those endowments are to provide annual operational support for 501 C3s that are located within the municipal boundaries. So general operating support is exactly what I think Representative Sadler was getting to. You know, in Homer, we've never competed with anybody. In fact, I think after 20 years in Homer, if you were to ask any 501 C3, they would say that the creation of a community foundation opened avenues of income to them that they never had before. So I think that what I would call a community fund needs to be specifically included within the language. And lastly, I believe that there should be some legislative guidance as to distribution of funds in new and existing funds. And I would not want to see just the existing funds have a priority over funding decisions. It's unsaid in the bill. Maybe you were leaving it to regulation, but I would like to see some guidance from the legislature if this moves forward. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Kim, could you restate your first concern? I missed the intent of that comment.
An unrestricted fund to a community foundation means that both the corpus and the earnings are available for distribution. Unrestricted use of earnings, I think, is really where you were going with that. But an unrestricted fund is a term of art. And I think that the intent was to place these and the matching monies into permanent endowments, the purposes of which would be unrestricted.
Okay. Does the sponsor want to address that specific language issue in the CS?
I'm sorry. I'm going to have staff address it. I step out for a second.
Okay. Aaron, would you like to?
Representative Munoz, I think that Ken may raise an important point, and I think that he's correct. It is the intention that they be endowed funds, the purposes of which would be unrestricted. And if he feels that there's some ambiguity there, I would defer to him. And so in looking at the bill then, I think that it would be on page 1, line 12, where perhaps the word unrestricted might be stricken, and then at the end of that line, add, comma, the purposes of which would be unrestricted.
Okay, again, where are you at on that?
Page 1, line 12.
Page 1, line 12.
Okay. Yeah, and it reads, the purpose of increasing unrestricted endowed funds, where it might better read, the purpose of increasing endowed funds,
Madam Chair. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm impressed how quick you are with this, but to avoid saying the purpose of twice, we might say as endow Alaska grants to increase endowed funds, the purposes of which would be unrestricted. So you're not saying the purpose of which twice. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Aaron, did you get that?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Yes, I think Representative Gardner.
She's quick.
could you read how that's real again?
Aaron, could you read that?
Could
you read that rewording, please?
Yes, Representative Munoz. As I've written what Representative Gardner has said, I believe it would read starting on line 11. Endow Alaska grants to increase endowed funds, the purposes of which would be unrestricted.
Exactly.
Okay. And if you could just write out that potential amendment, and then we'll have the exact language when the time is right. Then again, Ken raised, I think it was Ken or maybe Diane, but the issue of community funds as an addition to community foundations, community foundation affiliates. Did you want to address that point, Aaron?
Representative Munoz, we did spend some time trying to think about a mechanism that could be established through which communities that didn't have the local capacity, perhaps, to establish an affiliate. For instance, because there was a lack of people that were able to serve on the board. As we know, in many small communities, people are maxed out with board service. We thought about trying to create a structure that allowed that, and ultimately struggled and thought that it perhaps would be difficult to put into law. And I think it's a policy call. At this point, as it's written, you are giving the opportunity for communities or regions to establish either foundations or foundation affiliates and do fundraising to benefit them. That doesn't because there's the regional component, it doesn't exclude small communities from, for instance, being included in the Arctic Slope Community Foundation's umbrella, and many, many small communities being picked up. I just struggled for about a week trying to think about how to put it into the law, and I don't think that the activities precluded here. And so essentially,
okay, that's fine. We can get back to that when we get to that point. I have a question on the grant amounts, $25,000. Is that on an annual basis, or is it a one-time? That's on page 2. Or is it once you've gotten the grant, then you're not able to get it again? Could you just address that, please?
Representative Munoz, it's not meant to be one time, and I think it's meant to be per year.
And we may want to also address that in the amendments. Mm-hmm. And then also, what is the vision for funding this program initially? We have a zero fiscal note.
Representative Munoz, Representative Osterman is the money guy in our office.
Okay, Representative Osterman, could you answer that?
I'm sorry.
What is the plan on or what is the vision for funding this program to begin with?
Yes, we have a zero fiscal note from the Department of Commerce. We expect the grant funding to go through. They say that they can handle the pass-through grants on this. We have a zero fiscal note there. In this same similar to the other bill we just listened to, this may be going to be an undetermined fiscal note, so that we actually have that conversation about this will increase state funding. And so there's two different ways of looking at it, and this is a conversation that finance will have how they want to finance it. It would be that either you can have a yearly appropriation or you can set up an endowment to fund it. For example, if you set up a $3 million endowment and then spun the interest off for a year at 4.5%, I think it's around $135,000 a year that you could put into this program. Mm-hmm. Or you could have a yearly appropriation of $125,000 a year to fund these. And we anticipate somewhere between 4 to 6 applications at $25,000 a year, particularly a startup. So we would, this program may get to a point where it's no longer needed to be funded because of the number of foundations that will be brought around. So my guess is that in that light, that the Finance Committee would look at it as a yearly appropriation rather than the endowment. But those are the thoughts that we'll have when we get to Finance Committee to look at how it's to be funded.
Okay. All righty. All right. Thank you, Aaron and Representative Osterman. Also online, we have Scott Ruby with the Division of Community and Regional Affairs and Candace Winkler with the Alaska Community Foundation available for questions if the committee members have any of those individuals. Are there further questions or comments before we close public testimony? Okay. I'd like to move that we close public testimony. And hearing no objection, we'll go ahead and close the testimony at this point and bring the CS to the table for amendment. Get started here with the First Amendment. I would suggest is the inclusion of the word statewide. That was suggested by Diane Kaplan in the lead philanthropic entity on page 1. I can't offer the motion, though, if one of the other committee members would like to do that.
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Representative, Go ahead.
We also may look at page 2 under line 4. By inserting statewide in front of the organization may answer the same.
Okay.
And you could also do it, or maybe do it on both.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll offer Amendment 1, what he said.
Amendment 1, which would include the word statewide on page 1, line 9, following may identify a
statewide.
And then again on page 4, page 2, line 4, statewide added to number 2, a statewide organization. So an would be changed to a statewide organization.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Is there objection to the motion? No objection. Those changes will be made. We had a further amendment that would have added language to the effect of, you know, identifying unrestricted language on page 12 so that it's not unrestricted endowed funds, but the purpose of which the earnings of which would be unrestricted. And you had the language to that effect if you wanted to share it with one of the committee members.
Madam Chair, so the language that I wrote down that Rep. Gardner had presented would be on page 1, line 11, strike the word for in the following material and replace it with to increase endowed funds, the purpose of which would be unrestricted.
Okay. Who would like to make the motion? Representative
Gardner. Make the motion, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Amendment
2. Is there objection to Amendment 2? Hearing no objection, Amendment 2 passes. And then on page 2, line 31, did we want to, as a committee, specify that the grant can be done on an annual basis? Okay.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Gardner.
I'll move Amendment 3 to page 2, line 31, insert the word annually after the amount $25,000. Grants may not exceed $25,000 annually for each foundation and
okay.
community.
Those were the three amendments that I heard during the testimony. Are there additional amendments? No. Okay, what is the will of the body?
Question for the sponsor, or Aaron, was there an intent to have a lifetime, as it were, cap on grants? $25,000 per year, but is there a total absolute limit?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we have not discussed an absolute limit.
Yes, Representative Sadler.
I need to ask the sponsors a simple question, and maybe I've been led down. Just in terms of diagram, right now I've got the state of Alaska providing money, a matching grant to the Alaska Community Foundation. They put up $100, the state puts up $100. It goes down to a community foundation or a community foundation affiliate. Is the purpose then to have those community foundations or community foundation affiliates grow their endowments so that they can provide operating grants out to smaller 501c3s? So that's it? It's kind of a two-tier. One endowment.
Thing, yeah.
Right, I know, but it's an endowment here, endowment there.
Representative Munoz, if I could just clarify, Representative Sadler, ACF, or the lead philanthropic entity, would not be contributing the match. It would be the local entity. ACF would simply be administering the program with the state dollars being matched at the local level.
Okay.
Representative Gardner.
So just to follow up, the local would apply for it, and it would be kind of go through the system and be approved as comporting with the intent here and good policy, standards, since they don't have a local board.
Through the chair, yes, that would be the intent.
Okay. Further comments, discussion? Are we ready to move the bill today? Yes. Can I have a motion to move the bill? Representative Foster.
Madam Chair, I'll move from committee. It worked draft 27LS1094/D4Delta Kirsch with the three amendments and indeterminate fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, CS for HB 290 version D amended with indeterminate fiscal note passes the body. Thank you. Okay, so we want to pass around the report and we'll get going to the next bill. We're right at the end of the hour, so I'm going to allow the sponsor on the next bill to come forward, HB 184. Representative Peggy Wilson. Okay. Good morning. We have before us CS version R, and I believe, have we adopted CS? We have. Okay. So do you all have the most current CS? Mm-hmm. Everybody there?
Okay. Which version is
it? It's version R.
We adopted the last.
Okay.
All right.
I got it.
And I have everything.
Okay. Representative Wilson, we're right at the end of the hour. I'm going to let you make a statement about any changes or input that was given at the last committee, address those issues and questions, and then we'll try to move it at the next committee so that we have thoughtful debate and opportunity for comment and not rushed. So anyway, go ahead.
Peggy Wilson, District 2. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to talk about the bill. But we heard this last week, so I'm just, I think everybody knows about it. But Representative Osterman did ask for some information, and I think that it would be good for Tim Cottingham to come up and explain the information that he got.
Okay. Is it Jim or Tim?
Tim.
Tim. Tim, are you in the audience?
Yes.
Yes, Tim, come forward, please. Thank you. Tim,
record,
would you
I'm
go
Tim
ahead?
Cotton, Jim, with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. Excuse me, Madam Chair. At the request of Representative Osterman, I provided the committee a spreadsheet that is virtually identical to the spreadsheet that was already a part of this bill. That now breaks out what impact to each of the communities that was previously receiving sharing from the fisheries business tax would have if we looked solely at the export provision where revenues are shared back to communities from where fish were first landed before being exported from the state.
Okay, and that's the attached table, is that? You provided a table with that explanation.
Correct.
Representative Osterman, did you get a chance to review that information?
I did.
Do you have questions?
Mm-hmm. It's satisfactory. It actually shows what the difference would be if we didn't have the split of the 25 or the 50-50 and we went to 75-25. Part of my reasoning behind this, and I met with Representative Wilson the other day and talked about this, is that currently fisheries tax, landing tax that the state of Alaska gets, is split between the communities 50-50, and the state keeps 50, and the communities get 50%. If we go to taking another 25% and give it to the municipalities, that means 25% less to the state of Alaska for operating fish and game or for the general fund or however you want to look at it. And in my experience in the legislature, one of the big arguments that we've had sitting in finance committee has been the fisheries doesn't pay its way. And so if we continue to put money out of state funds into municipality, fisheries is going to even pay less way if you want to look at it in light of the taxes that are collected. And so I have a problem with this because, and my raise it last year, last meeting was that if this gets to finance, and finance looks at taking another 25% of the fisheries tax and give it to municipalities, that it may be something that they won't want to do. And if they don't do that, and the bill is there, and that was the reason of this chart, it actually shows what happens if you change the landing distribution without having the extra 25% on board. This chart shows you what exactly would happen if it went through. Now, Representative Wilson has indicated she'll pull the bill if the 25% additional 25% doesn't go to the municipality. But I, for full disclosure, I think that we should see what the difference is and why this bill has problems originally without the 25% change. And if you can just look at the numbers at how the distribution of those taxes would go and how they would move out of smaller communities into the bigger communities based upon not having the extra 25% in there. So.
Tim, we're talking, the bill, anyway, addresses two taxes, the fisheries business tax and the fisheries resource landing tax. The table that you prepared assumes that one of those taxes are removed from the formula in this bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. We understood the question from Representative Osterman. It was to pull out just the piece and the impact to just that piece that dealt with the exported unprocessed shares. And so what we did was we didn't even calculate the 75% at all. We just took the current 50% share provision that's in law now, took those shares, and then changed it based upon that single provision, which is exported unprocessed, being shared directly by DOR instead of it going to DCCED for them to allocate.
And isn't it true that if the bill as it's currently written moves forward and is not changed to amend one of those taxes, that the return on the communities is much greater? In fact, in most cases, there is no loss. There's substantial increased revenue.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I don't think there's any community that comes out with a loss at the 75% share along with this provision.
And we'll have the bill sponsor address this, but I understand that the intention is not to, or if the bill is amended to take out one of those provisions, that she would pull the bill. But you could address that when you come forward. Are there additional questions at this point? No. Thank you, Tim, for joining us. Okay. Representative Wilson, would you like to come back and address that point? And then we will move to close the meeting and take it up at our next meeting. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only comments that I would have are the fact that when you look at giving them the extra money to the municipalities, when the state was getting the 50%, they owned the harbors. And now most of the harbors have been turned over to municipalities, not all of them, but most of them have. And they have not been just given money to help them do that. This isn't by any means going to take care of it, but it will help because it's something that's ongoing. It never stops. I mean, there's always wear and tear in the harbors and whatnot, and this is a way to help them put some money toward their harbors. And so that's just really my statement, the fact that, and if this would change, I don't want it to be unfair to any of those municipalities, and so if they would try to decouple this, then I would hold the bill. I would withdraw it.
Okay. All right. Well, on that point, let's wrap up here. We're right at the end of the hour, and we will bring this up at our next meeting, and we will continue to work with you to get through the process. Okay. Thank you. Are there further issues or comments before we adjourn today? No? All right. Hearing nothing, thank you all. It was a good meeting, and we are adjourned at 5 minutes to the hour.